Funding for Think is made possible by SMU's Master of Liberal Studies.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. Are the ideals you hold worth dying for? It would seem that our terrorist enemies would answer yes to that question, and the strength of their identities reinforces their will to strike out against us. Many people find that disturbing and hope that a post-identity society might eliminate many sources of intolerance and violence. But my guest today believes our own identities, cultural, national, and spiritual, can serve as a powerful talisman against extremist beliefs and can strengthen the democracy we all value. Natan Sharansky was born in Ukraine and educated as a mathematician. He became an active Soviet dissident as an adult and was sentenced to 13 years forced labor for treason. In 1986, he emigrated to Israel, where he became active in politics and eventually served as deputy prime minister under Ariel Sharon. Currently, he serves as chairman of the Adelson Institute for Strategic Studies in Jerusalem. His latest book is called Defending Identity, Its Indispensable Role in Protecting Democracy. Natan, welcome to Think.
Thank you. Good morning or good evening. There it is.
Good afternoon. And good evening to you. You've written that making the case for identity is much harder these days than making the case for democracy. Why is that?
Well, of course, people want to be free and live in democracy, but people also want to belong, to the community of faith, to historical community, to national community. But now there's this feeling that because of these narrow loyalties to some small group of people, people are fighting with one another. That's what brings us wars. That again and again brings people to wish to live in the world, as John Lennon said, imagine the world without nations, without religion, the world where there is nothing to die for. And to prove that, in fact, the world where there is nothing to die for is the world where you can defend nothing, including your own freedom, is not a simple thing, but that's the truth with which I lived, which I tested in Soviet prisons, which I tested in the free world politics, and I really feel that identity and freedom should not be enemies, they should be allies.
Does identity require democracy?
Well, identity can, of course, exist without democracy, but then it can become fundamentalist, it can become totalitarian, it can become racist. Many bad things can happen. But if this democracy is not anchored in identity, it can become powerless, decadent, weak, which cannot defend itself. And that's why I do believe that identity and democracy need one another.
Yeah, I want you to talk maybe about what is different about identity in a repressive society as compared with one where things are allowed to be open.
Well, look, in fact, in all societies, identity gives adds the layer of meaning to your life. That you feel that your physical survival, your physical existence is not the only, it's not maybe the most important thing, that there are things which are very important for you to belong to this or that community, to be part of some historical story, to be part of your faith, and you are feeling that it is extremely important for you that this community will survive, or this community will succeed, and so on. It's true for all types of societies. It's not accidental that societies in the situation of war, whether it is totalitarian society or whether it is free society, they always appeal to these feelings of identity, of national pride, of faith, and so on. But the difference is that a free society permits coexistence of all types of identities. It doesn't see difference of identities, its enemy. So while in totalitarian regime, in fact, is trying to erase all identities except to its own.
Israel's former Deputy Prime Minister Natan Sharansky is my guest. His new book is called Defending Identity, Its Indispensable Role in Protecting Democracy. Can you talk, Natan, about the formation of your own identity as now an Israeli Jew? You started life in Ukraine at a time when your parents couldn't even give you a Jewish first name.
Yeah, that's true. And that's why maybe I was very lucky, because I was deprived of both identity and freedom. As every Soviet Jew, I was deprived of my identity. I could know nothing about my history, my tradition, my faith, in fact, even about Israel. The only Jewish thing which existed in my life was anti-Semitism. On the other hand, as all Soviet citizens, I was deprived of freedom. And I felt very well that the lack of freedom I felt, I always had to censor my own ideas, statements, thoughts, and so on. But I had no power to fight for it. I was absolutely powerless. And only when I discovered my own identity and started learning my history and found suddenly that there is a great story and there are great people and there is a great country, all this gave me strength to fight, to challenge the system, to fight for my own freedom, for freedom of other Jews, and then also for freedom of the other non-Jews. So for me, freedom and identity from the very first moment that I discovered them went together. And what is more important than when I went to prison, there I discovered two things. First, that the only way that you can resist to KGB, that's the name of secret police of Soviet Union, the only way that you can win in this battle when KGB tries to destroy you is if there are things which are more important for you than your own physical survival. And the second thing which I learned, that the best allies in your struggle against the KGB are other people with strong identities. Each of us can have very different identities. It can be Pentecostal, it can be Ukrainian nationals, it can be Catholic from Lithuania. But if all of us are linked with the idea that we want to live in free society, and each of us has things for which he is ready to die for, his own identity, that's what makes us very strong in struggling against totalitarian regime. And these things explained me very clearly that identity and freedom have to go together in the struggle for freedom. And what was so upsetting, that many years after, when we defeated Soviet Union, when we defeated communism, when Iron Curtain was broken, you discover yourself in the world where freedom and identity are standing on the different sides of barricades.
Ironically, when you were put in prison by the Soviets, you were accused of treason and of spying for the U.S. You actually were able to get a great education in dissident literature because all these confiscated books were there in prison with you.
Well, yes, I was really lucky that in that prison of KGB, so-called Lefortov prison, where I spent my first 18 months before the trial, there was collected one of the best and maybe the best library in the Soviet Union, because it all consisted from the literature confiscated from Russian intelligentsia, which was killed during the purges of Stalin. So suddenly, before interrogations, after interrogations, I could read all the classic literature of Sophocles and of Cervantes and all Shakespeare, of all the classical writers. And I discovered that, in fact, there are many, many allies whom I have. And that Antigona or Don Quixote or many other literary heroes, in fact, are people who know that there are things for me, that life is a great thing, but there are things for which it is worth to die fighting for these things. And that was they suddenly became my allies in the struggle against KGB.
When you discovered that your Jewish identity was something that you were, in fact, willing to die for if you had to, did you consider that at the time an act of defiance, or was it more personal than that?
Well, I think it was more. First of all, I discovered for myself that my life has very profound meaning, that, in fact, I can see the logics which connects 3,000 years exodus from Egypt and my today's struggle. So I also felt myself that I personally am somehow connected to many people all over the world with my own history. So it gave it made my life much more rich. But what is also very important, that it gave me strength to become a free person in the Soviet Union. It means to speak my mind freely. Because the moment you feel that history is on your side, you are not interested simply in your physical survival. You are interested in continuing to be part of the history of the struggle of free people for their freedom. And that's what gives you strength to say no to KGB, no to Soviet regime. So almost immediately, this personal discovery also became a shield in my struggle, in my public struggle.
And once you moved to Israel, and you were in a place where, I don't know that it's easy to be Jewish in Israel either, but it's a place where you're surrounded by people who share this sort of passionate beliefs that you have. Did your identity as a Jew change living there?
Well, I'd say that it's a very, very, very different experience, because if while living in diaspora in Soviet Union, you have to make an effort to feel yourself part of the Israeli struggle. While living in Israel, you have to make an effort to feel yourself connected to all the Jews of the world, that that your Israeli identity is not replacing your Jewish identity. In fact, that, I believe, is one of the challenges for Israel as a Jewish state, to feel, for the citizens, to feel themselves those who continue the history of thousands of years of Jews, and not as simply beginning absolutely new history of new people called Israelis. That's a challenge for me as a Jewish Israeli citizen. On the other hand, of course, Israel as a Jewish state has a challenge of having non-Jewish minorities, and what it is to be Jewish democratic state, it's also is a big challenge of how to link freedom and identity.
Well, Israel's a democratic state. Of course, as you mentioned, there is a non-Jewish minority. How do you respect the identities, and how does Israel respect the identities of, say, the Arab minority that lives there?
Well, it's clear that a narrative to which Jews feel themselves belonging is very different than the narrative to which Israeli citizens, Arabs, feel themselves that they are part of it. And I don't think that we have to impose the other citizens to live or to feel that they're part of our narrative. But what means Jewish democratic state means that every citizen has the same basic human rights, and also every group has its own national rights. So yes, I'm very proud by the fact that with all the difficulties, great difficulties which we have, the Arab citizens of Israel enjoy more freedoms than any other group of Arabs in any country of our neighbors. And that, let's say, when I was Minister of Interior, I accounted many facts of Palestinians who were trying sometimes even to bribe our authorities to get Israeli citizenship. I never saw, met, or heard about one case when any Arab citizen of Israel was ready to give away his or her Israeli citizenship.
Do Arab citizens in Israel have the same rights and freedoms as Israeli Jews?
Absolutely. Well, again, the fact that we are Jewish democratic state means, for example, that there is a law of return, which means that every Jew who decided to move to Israel has the right to do it. It doesn't mean that every Arab in the world who wants to move to Israel has the right to do it. But that's about those who are not citizens of Israel. As to those who are citizens of Israel, of course, they have the same access to education, the same economical rights, the same rights in terms of using our democracy in Knesset, and so on.
Natan Sharansky is my guest. He's a former Soviet dissident and deputy prime minister of Israel. His new book is called Defending Identity, Its Indispensable Role in Protecting Democracy. You'll have your chance to talk to him after the break. Just call 1-800-933-5372 or send an email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think is made possible by SMU's Master of Liberal Studies program, a way to keep your greatest two tools, creativity and curiosity, sharp. Details online at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is the former Deputy Prime Minister of Israel, Natan Sharansky. His new book is called Defending Identity, Its Indispensable Role in Protecting Democracy. If you'd like to join us, the telephone number is 1-800-933-5372, and that's where we find John in Dallas. Hello, John.
Hi. It seems to me that a lot of this stuff, a lot of these problems can be traced back to authoritarian mindset, in that, you know, authoritarian leaders tend to want to control, they tend to see people underneath them as non-entities. And it seems like they tend to, you know, when they attack a culture or an identity, they just make that culture defensive, which sets up a whole, you know, kind of a back and forth polarity. It also seems to me that every culture or every religion at some point includes the golden rule, which encourages us to look at people, you know, try to put ourselves in the other guy's shoes. And that another idea is the idea that a deity can be tribal in nature versus universal. Well, if you use the golden rule and put yourself in the other guy's shoes, you can't, if you do that on a regular basis, you can't hold that tribal idea of deity. You have to open yourself up to the universal, and it's just hard for me to imagine that a god could be anything but universal.
Thanks very much for your call. Natan, what do you think?
Well, I would say it's true that original attacks on other identities come from totalitarian regimes. And it's not accident, although the biggest attack on identity in the 19th, the beginning of the 20th century, was from Marxism, which wanted to raise all these different identities and to replace everything by class struggle, and we know what happened with this. But the situation becomes more difficult when we look at the world after the Second World War, when it was decided by many leaders, many intellectuals of the free world, that in order to build the stable world of peace, we have to overcome the prejudices of our own identity or the any importance of identity at all. And that's why when John Lennon was singing his anthem, Imagine, he in fact was saying what many intellectuals of the free world and many politicians of the free world were saying, that we need now post-national world. We need the world where identities are really not important, where people will not be ready to die for their religion or for their nationalism and so on. And patriotism became a negative world. And what we find out, that the free society, which is trying to erase or to minimize its own identity, becomes powerless when a small group of people who don't believe in democracy but who have strong identity attack it. And that's exactly what happened today in many European countries. That's what can happen practically with every place in the free world, where people don't have a strong will to fight for their freedom and understand that there are things which are more important than your own physical survival.
What's interesting about Europe is what you're observing there is in a place that really actively talks about embracing democracy and works hard to ensure that people start on a level playing field, but you actually see people's identity being repressed if they sort of differ from the norm.
What's interesting about Europe is it doesn't have to embrace democracy. It believes in democracy. Today it's built on democracy. It has maybe the most strong democratic societies in the world. But in Europe, there was a major attempt, in the last two generations at least, to overcome so-called prejudices of its own identity, to stop being patriots of your own countries. It's not accidental that in Europe today, practically, on Sundays, churches are empty, and on Shabbat, synagogues are empty, and the only place which is full is mosques on Fridays. And as a result, one after another, there are books how in the last years Europe found itself absolutely helpless against a small group of fundamentalists with very strong identities and with no belief in democracy. As one Dutch journal said, we found out that we know how to enjoy freedom, we don't know how to fight for freedom.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. My guest is Natan Sharansky. His new book is called Defending Identity, Its Indispensable Role in Protecting Democracy. Let's go next to Joe in Dallas. Hi, Joe.
Hi, my comment and a question. It occurs to me that what identity people will adopt often depends on how they feel they will be perceived by other people. My question was, Michael Shurer in his books say that we are told by our administration and by our presidents that the reason for the antagonism of Islam against Israel and the West in general is our ideas and our lack of freedoms. Well, Shurer says the real reason for the antagonism is the treatment by Israel of the Palestinians. And I was wondering what his opinion is about that, and perhaps he might comment on the moral legitimacy of Israel.
Well, I want to remind you that the PLO, as an organization which proclaimed that its target, that its aim is to destroy the state of Israel, and wrote it in its laws 25 times mentioning that the aim is to destroy the state of Israel, was created before 1967. I also want to remind you that Muslim Brothers organization, which is one of the basic bones, the main bones of today's terrorism in Muslim countries, was created long before the State of Israel appeared. I want to remind you that philosophy of Wahhabism, whose ideological base today of terrorism, of Al-Qaeda and many other organizations, appeared in this world centuries before Israel appeared. So it's very easy to connect everything with what happened in the last 25 years between Israel and Arab countries which tried to destroy it. But it will be much better if we look on all the history and find out that, yes, our world could very well coexist with the Muslim world, when Muslim world was not coming to these awful fundamentalist totalitarian ideas that everything non-Muslim has to be destroyed. But each time when this philosophy like Wahhabism or the theories like the theory of Muslim Brothers or the organizations like Hamas and Hezbollah were created, then it really becomes impossible and then collision is inevitable.
By its nature, Natan, identity can bind people together and can also create barriers to define the ways that people differ from one another. Is one of those forces innately more powerful than the other?
Well, first of all, the fact that people are different is not a bad thing. In fact, that's what creates, that makes life so rich and so interesting. And that if there are no differences between the people, then there will be, in fact, then no meaningful life. And it's true there will be no identities, but there will be, as they say, nothing to live for, nothing to die for. But it is very important that these differences between the people will nevertheless keep people open to the importance of the other differences, to be tolerant to the other. That's what I'm saying. That's why the identity has to be restricted, has to be friends by democracy. I have to say that when we in Soviet prison came from very different backgrounds with very different ideas, it's clear that Russia, it's very difficult to make compatible the world of Russian monarchists and Ukrainian nationalists Jewish Zionists from Moscow and Muslim from Crimea Tatars who were exiled to Siberia and so on. But when we were together in prison, very quickly we all discover that we want to live in the society in which people are not punished for their views. So we all want to live in accordance with our own identities, to feel ourselves part of our narrative, our story, our faith, and at the same time to be in the society where people are not punished for their views, what means to be tolerant and to be democratic. And that's exactly the mixture or the connection which has to be kept.
Does that also include, do you think, a protection for people who choose not to have a religious identity?
Oh, yeah. Look, religious is only one of the forms of identity. It's true that it's sometimes more spiritual or more mystical, or as a result, it has more chances, if not restricted, to become fundamentalist. But it's not a necessary, it's one important type of identity. For example, people can feel themselves very deeply part of some historical narrative, and they want to continue to be part of this historical narrative. But people can feel themselves part of some specific community with its traditional, let's say, of 200 years of American democratic tradition, and they want very much to continue to belong to this community with this tradition. Everything what makes your life more, bigger than your own existence, or every feeling of belonging that makes your life bigger than only the desire to continue your physical survival, that in fact comes to the identity.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. My guest is former Israeli Deputy Prime Minister Natan Sharansky. His new book is called Defending Identity, Its Indispensable Role in Protecting Democracy. Let's go next to Charlie in Lakewood. Hi, Charlie.
Hi. Natan, considering the recent remarkable victory of the Mossad in the Palestinian elections, what was the cause, identity or democracy or both?
Well, first of all, in Palestinian Soviet, unfortunately, there was never any democracy. And there was never any democracy, not simply because Palestinians don't want it, but because the free world decided that it is good for us, for free world, to have dictator who will be loyal to us. I want to remind you that so-called peace process started from the phrase that it is good that Yasser Arafat is not a Democrat, because without restrictions of democracy, he will fight Hamas much more successfully than we can do it. That's exactly, that was said in 93, and that's when I first time criticized so-called peace process. Because from the very beginning, it was built on the idea that what is important for us with Palestinians, it's not, God forbid, freedom and democracy, it's to have dictator who will be loyal to us. And as a result, for 15 years, the free world, including Israel, including America, including Canada, including Europe and Japan, we are building or helping to build one of the most primitive and corrupt dictatorships, which in the end was hated by its own people. So when the time came, or when they were given the moment to choose between corrupt dictatorship of Yasser Arafat and Hamas the terrorists, who may be want to kill all the Jews, but at least they are taking care of the poor and the ill. They, as a protest against that corrupt dictatorship of Yasser Arafat, voted for Hamas. What I was saying in my previous book, the Case for Democracy, and in many articles and speeches, elections, it's not democracy. Free elections and free society, that's what democracy. We had to concentrate, all of us, all the free world, had to be interested to encourage building civil society on the Palestinian side. And then we could come with elections. If our Palestinians, after building main institutions of civil society, could choose not only between secular terrorists of Yasser Arafat and religious terrorists of Hamas, but if they could also choose between real democratic dissidents of Palestinians with whom I have excellent relations, with whom I'm dealing almost every day, I think then the result could be very different.
Natan, beyond preserving people's rights to have their own beliefs and their own cultural traditions, what, if any, is the proper role of the government in the formation of identity?
Well, okay. First of all, governments can fight identities, they can strengthen identities, or they can weaken identities. And what we saw in the atmosphere of so-called multiculturalism, when so many countries of the free world displaying respect to identity, to different identities of the people who suffered from the colonialism, at the same time demonstrated that their own identity, the identity of their own countries, has absolutely no meaning. And as a result, there was a concentrated policy of becoming cosmopolitan, of convincing ourselves that after all the nations and all the cultures are equal means that there is no specific value or meaning or importance in supporting our own identity. And I think that now there are second thoughts among many of these societies and governments who understand that patriotism is not a bad word more than this, that you need to appeal to the patriotism of your own citizens when your culture is in danger.
Our email address, if you'd like to speak to Natan Sharansky, is think@kera.org. We have one from Basil in Dallas who writes, I find it utterly hypocritical that you would be willing to die for your Jewish identity and call that a noble thing, but call the Palestinians terrorists for asserting their own identity. By the way, the Arabs in Israel don't want to give up their Israeli citizenship, not because of love for Israel, but because it is their only way to remain on their land. What do you say to that?
Well, I have to say that I respect, not only respect, I think it's very important that every Muslim and every Arab and every Palestinian who stick to his or her identity and be ready to die for this. The problem is when people are not when they are ready to die for their identity, but then when they are ready to kill as a terrorist many other people and in order to destroy society, identity which they don't like. I don't know any case that Israel started war against Palestinians and Palestinians. I know many cases when Israel, I know all the cases when Israel had to fight terror, and yes, in the fighting against terror, we had sometimes to use weapons from which peaceful population also was suffering, what is practically inevitable when you are facing the war, especially when you are facing the war with such cruel terrorists. Again, it is very important to differ between people who are ready to die for their identity and people who are ready to kill the others because they don't like their identity. And that's exactly the difference between our enemies and our friends.
Natan Sharansky is my guest. He's a former Soviet dissident and political prisoner. He also was Deputy Prime Minister of Israel. His new book is called Defending Identity, Its Indispensable Role in Protecting Democracy. We'll take more of your calls and emails after the break. You can get on the line to join us at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think is made possible by SMU's Master of Liberal Studies program, a way to keep your greatest two tools, creativity and curiosity, sharp. Details online at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think at on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Natan Sharansky. His newest book is called Defending Identity, Its Indispensable Role in Protecting Democracy. If you want to join us, you can call 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. Natan, over and over in this hour, the idea has come up that one should be willing to die for his or her identity. I'm wondering if you think it's just beyond the realm of imagination to think that we might work for a time when that's out of the equation, when no one has to consider dying for their identity.
Well, the fact that you must be ready to die doesn't mean that there must be a situation in which you have to die. It's not beyond imagination to live in society when nobody threatens your identity and all the identities are living in peace and democracy. Of course, that's a little bit idealistic, but I hope that with the time we will reach this stage, and the number of democratic societies is increasing practically all the time. But while there is a situation in which there is tolerant societies and non-tolerant societies, tolerant groups and non-tolerant groups, in order to be able to defend your right to be free, you must be ready to accept that your physical survival is not the highest value, that survival as a free person, it is a highest value, that to live in accordance with your identity, that is the real freedom and that's the life that you want to have. And you're ready to resist, to attempt to take it away, up to the fact that you will be ready to fight and to die. The moment you decide that you'll die for nothing, and I was in this station when KGB was trying to convince me and the other dissidents, the most important thing is your physical survival, So give up, give us your souls, forget about your inner freedom, about your pride, and that's it, and you will survive. And if we accept it, that physical survival is the most important thing, then totalitarian regime could prevail in the Soviet Union and all over the world, in every place where people are not ready to fight for their freedom. And what I'm saying, that identity, that very important force which gives meaning to your life, that's your shield, which gives you opportunity to protect yourself from the attacks on your freedom.
Where do we define the limits of our tolerance for different kinds of identities? For example, in certain cultures, it might be acceptable for one to abuse one's spouse or one's children, or practice plural marriage or underage marriage. Where do we decide?
Well, I'll tell you, the moment we permit these people to become part of our society, and in fact, let's say again, if you take Europe, as a result of this multicultural view of the world, Europe became very open, very tolerant, very liberal in permitting everybody, all the groups with their own cultures, to be part of our society. More than this, the idea of multiculturalism is that no cultures are more important. Your own French or English culture is not more important than the culture of people who are coming from Nigeria and so on. And as a result, it was decided that you cannot dictate to these people anything. And suddenly we find out that in the modern European society, there are hundreds, if not thousands, cases of honored killings, of
there are thousands of honor killings in Europe?
There are, well, in every case which was tested, it was in every case, in every part of Holland or any other country, it was discovered dozens of cases of honored killings. There was never a study all over Europe, also because of this fear of the discovery. But now officials in England, France, Holland know about hundreds and hundreds of cases of honored killing. There is no doubt that if all the information would be collected, we'll be talking about thousands. And now society understands that they have to fight against it, that you cannot accept that the people who are joining your free society have to accept that their the display of their identity has to be restricted by the rules of democratic society. I'll give you an example. United States of America, we are not ready to accept Salt Lake City, Utah, as a part of America, as long as the population of Utah didn't accept that monogamy is the guiding principle of their society. The same as happen practically with every person, with every group of nationals who are accepting European citizenship. Now, at the same time, you should not fight against their identity only in the name of absorption. For example, I believe that the war which was waged in Europe against veil, against covering the face of Muslim girls who go to public schools, and as a result they were passed the special laws in a number of European countries prohibiting to Muslim girls to cover their faces if they go to public school, I believe it was a major mistake. You're not fighting against identities. You're fighting against only those displays of identity which are contradicting the principles of democracy.
We have an email from Joseph who writes, "Do you see a difference between individual identity and cultural identity? I see how our individual identity plays an important role in our democratic nations, but can the communal identity of a socialist or communist nation have a similar, if not equal, impact?"
Well, I think America is a great example of individual identities, communal identities, religious identities. In fact, America was based on the principle of defending the rights of different communities to have their communal identities. At the same time, it has to go together with the basic code of the rights of individual, of human rights. So on one hand, community cannot take away from every individual their individual rights. On the other hand, individual can enjoy this feeling of belonging to the community of faith or community of nations or community of history to which he wants to belong.
Do you think, Natan, that identity is always or should always be a conscious choice for people? Is it something that we ought to think about and decide as opposed to sort of just going with what feels right?
Well, look, first of all, people are born in some identities. It doesn't mean that they cannot change it, but it's a very individual and very deep process, and I think that for many people, when they choose to stay in this identity or they choose rationally to change this identity, identity becomes a much more meaningful thing than for people who are simply born in this identity and never appreciate it.
Mm-hmm. What do you think is at work when people reject the identity that's been given to them by those around them?
Well, look, that's legitimate. I think that people who are rejecting any identity, who think that they want to be people of the world. And I was born in a society where a big group of people believed that that is the best way to live. It's to belong to all the world at the same time. These people, in the end, have a very decadent life. They cannot defend any values, or they become assisting to some of the most vicious regimes, like it happened with communism. But people who rationally decide to change their identity, for example, to convert from one religion to the other, and decide to become part of different history, of different narrative, I think they can be very happy in it and can be very strong defenders of this identity and of the right of people to choose what means of democracy.
Going back to Europe for a minute, Natan, do you think that it's possible that Europe is not so much beyond identity as in a period of transition where identity is harder to define and is sort of moving toward whatever it will end up being?
Well, look, all our world, global world of freedom and removing of many barriers, economical, communicational, others, is a world where identities are not so clearly defined as before. Simply the easiness with which you can move from one tribe to the other, from one country to the other, from marrying to the other religion, sometimes change your sexual identity, as we know. The easiness with which you can do it makes all these borders, the divisions, much more vague. But as to Europe, in fact, I think that what we are seeing in the last few years is the beginning of the back process, when suddenly many Europeans are really concerned with the fact that that democratic national identities, which they were building for hundreds of years, are in danger, makes them to take a step back. And I think it's not accidental that people like Merkel or Sarkozy are winning elections, and Livingstone, the mayor of London, is losing elections, because Livingstone is connected in the minds of people with the multiculturalism and trying to erase European identity, while these leaders are connected in the minds of the people with attempts to strengthen European identity.
There are people who haven't purposely rejected their national or cultural identity or their religious identity, but they just don't feel any connection to it. Do you think
in fact, I would say the main pathos of my book is exactly directed to these people, that you may be very lucky that the life didn't make you to feel the need in this. But remember that comfort of your life, which you're enjoying, can be in danger if you are not ready passionately to defend it. If you don't see that this comfort is not simply your individual choice, but it is part of something much bigger, which must be very important for you and for what you must be ready to fight.
So you think people have an obligation to find some identity that they can really hold on to?
So people don't have any obligation. Nobody in the normal democratic society, nobody forces you to find identity. I say that your life will be more meaningful, your life will be more deep, and will be more protected if you rediscover your own identity for yourself.
A lot of people talk about globalism as a potential threat to identity, or at least, you know, we all sort of share an identity that's global. Do you think, though, there's a chance that people will actually seek things that are sort of much closer to home than they have in recent decades?
They'll be much more closer to home?
Mm-hmm.
I'm sorry, I didn't understand.
Will people, with sort of the global movement, do you think people will look for their identities closer to home, or do you think identity is more threatened than ever?
I think in the end, as we discovered again and again during the wars, when Stalin suddenly found himself in the war, or when French people or American people found themselves in the war, they stopped any attempt to undermine their own identities, to undermine the importance of patriotism, the importance of religious values. And they understood very quickly that not the people would be ready to fight, and if necessary to die, they will fight for their family, for their home, for their faith, for their tribe, for their nation. And that is the way to defend freedom. And the very fact that both democratic leaders and dictators are coming to the same conclusion simply shows how identity is important as a shield.
Last thing I want to ask you, Natan, is do you think that identity is something that we should strive to formulate so that it can remain fixed, so that we'll sort of achieve that point in our lives where we know that our identity is solid? Or should we all expect that the things and the ideals that we value and hold dear will continue to evolve over our entire lives?
Well, I think if you want to have an interesting life, you should better keep developing your concepts, your ideas, your feelings, and so on. I think that when people are already formed and feel that nothing can change in their attitudes and their understanding of their own identity, when there is nothing to learn about it, when there is nothing to learn from it, life becomes much more boring. So I do believe it's good if it's kind of developing concept in your life. But to say that that's obligation, no, nobody obliges you. But if you really want, if you're enjoying your life, your free life, and you want to continue enjoy this life in today's not very simple world of confrontation of ideas, you'll better strengthen this feeling of your own identity.
Well, I think no one can argue at this point that you have thus far lived a very interesting life. Natan Sharansky is a former Deputy Prime Minister of Israel. He serves as chairman of the Adelson Institute for Strategic Studies in Jerusalem. His latest book is called Defending Identity, Its Indispensable Role in Protecting Democracy. Natan, thank you so much for spending the hour with us.
Thank you very much.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thank you for listening. Have a great day.
Think is produced by Jeff Whittington and engineered by Jeannie Mascoro. Learn about upcoming programs, subscribe to our free daily podcast, and order CD copies of your favorite Think shows on the radio page of KERA.org. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@KERA.org.